I'm not pulling out of the driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another Drive to Work, Coronavirus Edition. Okay, so I've been doing some fun interviews, and I have yet another fun guest. So, Ethan Fleischer, say hello.
Hello.
So, Ethan actually, by the way, is my first guest in this sort of interview that was actually in my car at one point, back when I did interviews with people sitting next to me.
That's right. Me and Matt Cavalda and a few other people got to ride in your car with you.
Yes, the old school interviews when they would actually carpool. If you want, Ethan and I talked all about the Great Designer Search, which is how Ethan got into this. And so we're not going to talk a lot about the Great Designer Search today, just because we did a whole podcast on that. But if you want to hear about Ethan and the Great Designer Search, there's 30 plus minutes of that, of him writing with me. So anyway, so Ethan, we're going to start with a question I've been asking everybody, which is, how did you get into magic?
Oh, my friend in high school went to Gen Con and brought back a bunch of Alpha Magic cards, and he was very excited about it. He's like, we've got to try this. And our whole gaming group tried out playing with the magic cards, and we loved it. And then we were like, we got to buy this. And we couldn't, because there weren't any. And we had to wait until, I think, Arabian Nights came out and Unlimited came out before we could actually buy the cards. But we were hooked right from the beginning as soon as the game came out.
Okay, so did you play continuously from first learning about Magic up till you entered the Great Designer Search, or was there off times in between?
No, I took breaks here and there. You know, whenever I moved, I would, you know, lose my old gaming group, and it would take time to hook people on Magic again. But by the time I entered the Great Designer Search, I was working in a bookstore, and I had introduced Magic to a bunch of the people there, and we had a league going at the store. And actually, we started selling Magic cards at the bookstore also. So I did my part to spread the love.
Okay, so you, I don't know if it's on a whim, but you decided to try out for the Great Designer Search.
Obviously, a whim.
What? Was it a whim?
It was a whim.
So obviously you won the second Great Designer Search, and we brought you on to Wizard. So once again, we have a whole podcast about the Great Designer Search. Go listen to it. But we're going to jump ahead to your days at Wizards. So in fact, I want to jump ahead. First off, what's it like? You have been an outsider, and all of a sudden you're working at Wizards. What was that like?
It was a little bit crazy and a little bit almost alienating, I guess, because a lot of the people who worked in the department had been like pro tour people, or like, we were all on the same team together in Pittsburgh or whatever. And I felt very much like an outsider for some time until, you know, I had gotten some reps under my belt and felt like I knew what I was doing. Also, I'd never done a professional game design before before working at Wizards, though I did a bunch of amateur game design for my own amusement.
Well, same for me. So this was my first game design job. Okay, so let's talk about some of your reps, getting your reps. So the very first set that you led the design for, this is back in the old school design development days, was Journey into Nyx. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Right, so that's back when we did a large set followed by two small sets all together in a block. And this was a challenging way to do sets, I think. And I think as we've continued to change our process, it's become more and more clear that maybe that just wasn't the best way to do things for the first 20 years of Magic.
Okay, so...
So it was like we had Theros, which was this... this set that was about enchantments and Greek mythology. And we had the sequel to that set, Born of the Gods, which was about all these enchantment creatures coming to life. And then for Journey into Nyx, I wanted to have a war between the mortals and the gods. I don't think that really came through as loudly as I would have wanted it to. But as far as the mechanics of the set, I wanted to introduce a set for mechanic for the mortals and a mechanic for the gods. So we had Constellation, which turned out to be quite successful. People really liked it, and that was a thing that triggers whenever an enchantment enters the battlefield under your control. There was a constellation deck in Standard. Everyone recalls it fondly. And then the other mechanic was Strive, which nobody remembers because it's not that exciting of a mechanic.
So what did Strive do?
You were able to pay extra mana to add more targets to a spell. So it was like you could just cast the spell normally, and then you could pay it as sort of kicker cost, a multi-kicker cost kind of, to add targets. And this was to interact with the heroic mechanics. You could target a bunch of your heroic cards and trigger them all at once. But it wasn't particularly noteworthy, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those mechanics that play just fine. It just isn't very memorable, I think.
Yeah. And I don't think I designed that mechanic. I think that was Eric Lauer designed that during the development team. So I had some other mortal mechanic that was just totally out of control. I think it doubled the counters on everything every turn. And you really liked it. But
I did.
For some reason, the developers weren't so hot on it.
Sounds like my kind of mechanic. Yeah. Okay, so what was the last? So you were on, I remember this, you were on all three design teams, so you actually were through the whole block.
Right.
We were trying to set you up for your first lead.
Yeah, so I was on all three design teams, and I felt like I had a lot of input even that early on in my career there into, you know, some of the themes and what was going on. So, that was really exciting. I felt very invested in Theros as a world, as a setting. I'm always very interested in the creative and world building end of things, though I focus on game design. The idea that we're sort of collaboratively creating worlds, both within the company and with the players, like the players participate in the stories that happen in this world. Feeling like I had contributed toward creating this whole new world in this fantasy IP was very exciting for me.
Yeah, one of the things, for a little behind the scenes for the audience, you are kind of known for all the designers for being the most, having the greatest knowledge of story and of worlds. One of your passions, obviously, is you're very invested. And like when you do a set, you make sure you know all the backstory of all the things, whatever the world is, and then you spend a lot of time on that. I know something that you have a lot of passion for.
Yeah, for Theros, I had a decent background in Greek mythology, but you know, I read Homer's Odyssey and Iliad in preparation just to like get into the mode, and of course, almost infamously. For Dominaria, I went completely nuts and read like every single book that was set in Dominaria during the whole Dominaria world building and design process, which is like 90 something books.
Yeah, it's a lot of books. Okay, so let's move on to your next one. So the next set you led was Oath of the Gatewatch. So we went back to Zendikar, had a little war. So talk about that set.
Right. So, the idea there was that we were going to have a giant war between the Eldrazi, for these huge space monsters, and the people of Zendikar, and it was going to be kind of a Pacific Rim kind of thing. Unfortunately, I think we kind of tacked a little bit toward the weird, and it ended up being a little less like Pacific Rim and a little more like a David Cronenberg film or something. But we wanted to have the first set, Battle for Zendikar, be focused on Ulamog, who was this destructive titan. And then Oath of the Gatewatch was going to be focused on Kozilek, who was like the weird transmuter one. And then we were going to have the third Eldrazi titan, Emrakul, show up in Eldritch Moon, which was a couple of sets later, and on the Innistrad plane. The thing that I was really excited about to do for Oath of the Gatewatch was to introduce this colorless mana mechanic where it was had a colorless mana cost as opposed to a generic mana cost. So you had to use colorless mana to cast the spells or activate the abilities with the little diamond shape mana cost. This was an idea that I saw John Laux's pitch during the designer search, and I was like, this is an intriguing idea, and we just need the right place for it. And it really felt like that was a cool twist to do for Battle for Zendikar block. I kind of wish we'd ended up doing it throughout the whole block, but yeah. So that mechanic was interesting to me because it was backward compatible with cards from the first Magic set, even like Sol Ring can be used to pay for your colorless mana costs. So we were able to make some pretty efficient cards, and there were powerful cards that made colorless mana. So they actually had made a big splash in every format that they were legal in, and even were too strong in Modern. We ended up having to ban a card because the colorless mana cards were too strong in the context of Eye of Ugin and Eldrazi Temple or something. So it was a little too strong there, but it was very exciting, and it broke Magic Online, if I recall correctly. It took them months to program it. So since then, we've changed our process so that we try not to break Magic Online with new mechanics.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of the things I get asked about all the time. I think a lot of players don't realize that we can't just like throw one in a, like, there's a lot of support you need to make it work in a set. I get a lot of people like,
yeah, making that work in Limited was really tricky. We had a whole bunch of different lands that could produce colorless mana, and we even introduced basic lands that tap for colorless mana called Wastes. Which I think that might be my favorite card in the set is Wastes, just because it's it's so weird. It's like, how many people get to put a new basic land in the set? You've never done that, have you?
I've never done that. That doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
The one other thing real quickly that might be interesting for people to know about behind the scenes is midway through your design, we got a request from, I think, Brand, saying that they really wanted to play up the story. Like, that we were all in on, like, it's Coastal, like, whatever. And then they're like, oh, by the way, it's going to be called Oath of the Gatewatch. And you had a sort of, like, mid, right?
Early enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came early enough that it was possible to, like, add design elements to the set to support the idea of this team of planeswalkers coming together. And so we added
the Oaths.
Well, there was the two-headed giant facing mechanic, right?
Teammate mechanic. What was that called? Well, we'll come to us. We had the teammate mechanic.
If you or your teammate had cast a spell this turn, you could cast it for its alternate cost.
Right.
And there was actually also another one that support mechanic, which we've actually used a couple of times since. Mm-hmm. The support mechanic put +1/+1 counters on things. And actually, in my original design, it could also put loyalty counters on planeswalkers.
Yep.
But
that changed last minute, by the way. That changed last minute.
That did. That changed after the slideshow. Because, like, we looked at the slideshow and it was just like, this set is too complicated and it's too weird. And this one thing seems like we could change it without unbalancing everything. Let's change it. So we ended up changing support so it only worked on creatures, which, like, at the time I was kind of disappointed. Like, oh, I was about planeswalkers teaming up. That's too bad. But then later we used support in, like, I think at least two other sets. So it was like, This is a solid mechanic that is fun to play with. So I can't feel too bad about that.
Okay, so let's so let's move on to your next set that you led. Actually, this one you co-led with a dashing young co-lead, Amonkhet.
Right. So we teamed up on this one. This was when you were like training me and Sean Main up to lead large sets,
yeah.
And so. And I remember the plan originally was to have Amonkhet and Kaladesh switched in the schedule from where they were. And I was very excited to lead this, like, sci-fi steampunk set, and Sean was like had grown up in Egypt and was like ready to lead Amenket, and then we like moved them in the schedule. I was like, oh, actually,
yes.
So we're gonna do it this way.
We had to swap them. We swapped them late too. I mean, like it was during exploratory or something. We swapped them, I think.
Yeah, I remember Amenket had a little bit of exploratory design under Sean,
right?
And then later, I picked up and restarted the exploratory design.
So
that one was based on ancient Egypt, like mostly on the historical ancient Egypt rather than ancient Egyptian mythology, though there was a little bit of mythological stuff in there. In general,
well, and the reason for that, real quickly for the audience is. The audience, what we found was the average person just didn't know a lot about Egyptian mythology, so it was hard for us to go too deep because no one recognized it, so.
Right. The thing with Greek mythology is that it has remained in continuous currency ever since it was written. People have been telling it and retelling it over the years for millennia now. Whereas Egyptian mythology was just lost for a long time. It just disappeared. Nobody knew how to read Egyptian writing anymore. And so almost all of those stories were just lost to the collective consciousness of humanity. And then they only, you know, discovered how to read Egyptian writing again like 100 years ago. And by that point, the amount of impact that those stories could have on the culture was pretty minimal.
So what was Amenket design like?
Amenket design was a breeze, as I recall. It was really fun. We came up with some sweet mechanics that made like mummies come back to life, and we had these monuments that we built up. A lot of the people on the team had played a lot of Civilization over the years, which is this very popular video game series where you kind of usher a civilization from the Stone Age all the way up to modern times. And one of the things that you always do in Civilization is you build these monuments, and it takes time to build them, and you have to like invest a lot into building a monument. But once you have it, it's like, oh, I've got this awesome monument. So we made some sweet monument building cards. But ultimately, like, Egypt wasn't enough to kind of fill out a set or two sets, as it were. We were down to two set blocks by this point. And we incorporated sort of Nicol Bolas, who's the villain of the storyline at that point, Nicol Bolas's personality into the set. So the place became this sort of evil, corrupt, dystopian world, and we incorporated a sort of Stepford Wives creepiness into the design and the world building and like creative text to make it look like this is a perfect society on the outside, but like clearly there's some horrible lie underneath, and you know, these people are deeply messed up.
Yeah, the dissonance was pretty cool. That's one of my favorite things about the set, of how, like, on the surface it looked like everything was okay, but the mechanics really said, no, it wasn't. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I do like how it hung together in that regard. I don't feel like I feel like focusing so much on the kind of emotional down point of the story at that point may have alienating some of the audience that wasn't like along for the ride for the whole story. Mm-hmm. It's like the low point of the story is during Amenket block.
Yeah.
And from a storytelling standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. But from a like, is every set as cool and exciting as it could be? Maybe that wasn't the right decision to make in retrospect. Like, everything should be cool and awesome and aspirational, and this one was kind of like a little bit miserable.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little dark. I mean, it was definitely a little bit darker. I mean, I think sets can have different tones to them. And hey, it was not nearly as dark as Hour of Devastation.
Yeah, that's true. Power of Devastation was very bleak.
Yeah, that was pretty bleak. Okay, let's move on to Modern Horizons, another set you and I definitely worked on together. So we'll talk about what happened. How did Modern Horizons come to be?
So, just for context, my favorite Magic set, when I came into Wizards, was Time Spiral. Like, this was a set that was all about referring to the game of Magic's history in a really fun way. It also kind of marked a serious downturn in Magic sales, because it was like, this is the only way to experience Magic the Gathering right now is to play with this set. And the set was very much aimed at a very specific audience. But during my time at Wizards, we started making more and more ancillary products that were aimed at specific audiences. And I thought, oh, this would be a really good idea to make an ancillary product that's like Time Spiral. And I know you were thinking along similar lines. Your idea was a little bit different. I don't remember exactly.
I think I pitched mine as another future site, but I mean, you and I had the same basic idea of, let's do something that's for a more enfranchised crowd, that's deeper and more complex, that really plays in the nostalgia of Magic.
Right. So when we put together a little mini team we do like a game jam that we call the hackathon every couple of years. So it was, I think it was you and me and Allison Medwin and Nat Mose.
Yeah, that was
the, and we just team. Like built a large set in like 4 days.
Yes, we did.
So that it could be drafted. We built a draftable large set in 4 days and then demoed it on the fifth day, because it was a 5-day hackathon. Yep. With an actual draft.
Yep.
And which that was pretty crazy. But it really, set us up for success, because it was super fun. It was high complexity, and there were every keyword mechanic that was legal and modern, I think we decided to put in it.
Up to a certain point, we cut off at you can only go up to a certain point, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There were some later mechanics that we didn't use.
Yeah.
Everybody was really excited about it, and we decided to make it very quickly. There was, like, very little time between the hackathon presentation and, like, launching the vision design team. So I co-led the vision team with Mark Globus. I kind of handled the standard design problems, and he was sort of the point person for some of the special challenges associated with the set, because we decided to make it legal and modern, which normally sets have to be legal and standard before they can enter modern. And we thought that modern was big enough at this point that it would be a good idea to do that. And we were planning to launch Pioneer pretty soon. So it seemed like this was a pretty good time to try something like this. And it was so much fun. We got to just design crazy, crazy cards.
It was fun.
Mix and match mechanics on the same card. And we didn't do as many of the old legendary characters as I wanted, because we needed to save a lot of that for Commander Legends, which is still upcoming. But so that's the reason why there's only a few new legends in Modern Horizons. But it's really just a Melvin's dream, this set, and I really like that about it.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I obviously designed original Time Spiral, and that was a blast to do as well. But yeah, it's do you remember the code name?
Oh, what was the code name?
Decadent.
Decadence, right? Decadence. I wanted the booster packs to look like a fancy chocolate bar wrapper or something. Yeah. With just like, you know, tiny gold letters with the logo on like a velvet black background or whatever. But we ended up doing something else. We kind of tacked heavily into the modern legality as far as the marketing of the set. So, but yeah, it we got to just be totally self-indulgent there, which as a game designer, we rarely have the luxury of doing. Like, ultimately, we're trying to design these things for an audience that isn't us.
Yes.
And for Modern Horizons, we very much got to, make a set for ourselves, and that was really fun.
Okay, next up is Theros Beyond Death.
Theros Beyond Death.
Yep.
So as the person who'd been on all three Theros design teams, well, I guess you were on all three.
I was on all three as well, I guess, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a person who was on all three Theros design teams, I got the chance to go back to this world that I'd helped make years earlier and tried to figure out what it's the best way. We kind of struggle a little bit, I think, figuring out exactly how to return to different worlds, like returning to Ravnica and returning to Innistrad and returning to Dominaria and returning to Theros all kind of feel like they have different challenges to solve.
Yeah.
And so figuring out what's the essence of Theros and what's the new thing that we want to incorporate here. Obviously Theros is about Greek mythology, but I also think Theros is about enchantments. I think that we knew we needed both of those things. And then as far as story-wise, we actually had a much clearer idea of what the story was going to be for Theros Beyond Death than we did for any of the other sets around it. Elspeth is going to escape from the underworld. She died at the end of the story last time. She went to the underworld, but that place leaks like a sieve. And we knew Elspeth was gonna bust out of there. It's gonna be jailbreak from the underworld. So I always thought of the working title in my mind was Elspeth in Hell. We didn't obviously go for that, but we tried a bunch of different enchantment-y mechanics, and ultimately I decided that we just got it right the first time. Constellation was the right mechanic that interacted with enchantments in a way that made sense, and so we ended up keeping that. There was another... What were the other mechanics in that set? I know it just
Devotion,
but like,
I mean... We brought back Devotion.
Right.
We brought back Constellation.
We kept Devotion also because that was the sort of defining mechanic for the original block. Like that was engendered these crazy decks that you almost never saw. Like mono black control was back and mono blue Devotion, like mono blue decks had not been a thing for many years. And so the original Theros brought this Devotion mechanic in that the players really embraced. And then the thing I tried that ultimately didn't work out for a variety of reasons was this river mechanic, where you would put a cardboard river down the middle of the table and your creatures could either be on the living side of the river or the dead side of the river. This was, represented the river Styx. That went out of the underworld in Greek mythology. We tried that, and early in set design, ultimately, like, too many problems piled up with it, and they had to cut it. Yeah. So we got the escape mechanic instead. I think, did Mark Gottlieb design that one?
I think Mark Gottlieb made the escape mechanic.
Yeah. So... The river didn't work out. We thought it was going to be awesome in digital and not so great in paper. And then it turned out it was going to be not so great in digital and not so great in paper. So it was a valuable lesson in making sure that there's lots of communication with like the user interface and user experience designers on the digital teams, just because like we had assumptions and it turned out those assumptions were pretty far off base. So we like to think that we're smart and can do everything, but actually there are specialists who know how to design a user interface, and we ain't them.
Yeah, one of the things that is interesting about design is we're the first people to do stuff. So there's all these people downstream that have to make use of the stuff you're using. And a lot of, I guess, what you learn over time is getting better about communicating with those people to make sure that you understand what they want so that you're delivering something that each of those teams can use effectively.
Yeah. And ultimately, I think that the escape mechanic, while not quite as crazy and radical as the river was, is a lot of fun and tells the story that we wanted to tell, which was we're in the underworld and people are escaping from the underworld. And we even got to make an Elspeth Planeswalker card with the escape mechanic on it. So I feel like it all turned out in the end, and like we kind of got the greatest hits of Theros mechanics, of which there were many from the original block. Because I think the original set had like three mechanics, and then each of the additional sets added two mechanics. So like there were seven a lot of mechanics by the end. So we picked the best two and got the escape mechanic. And then as far as world building went, we got to do the world building for the whole underworld, as well as the Minotaur cities and stuff. So we got to expand our view of what's in Theros. And I imagine if we ever go back to Theros again, we'll move the camera even farther back and we'll see some more of that world. I do like that model where like the world is getting bigger and bigger as we go back there. It's kind of what we did in Dominaria when you think about it, only I felt like that was in a sort of a more ad hoc sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously in Returns, we're always showing you more aspects and more things, and it's always a challenge. But anyway, I'm almost to work. So so I want to point out that you've also done a lot of work on Commander stuff, which will probably be a different podcast. Maybe at some point I'll have you back on, and we'll talk about all the Commander stuff you've done, because you've led a whole bunch of Commander teams.
Yeah, I'm tied for the most Commander teams, tied with Glenn Jones, I believe. Yeah. We've done a lot of Commander.
So that'll be a different podcast. But so I want to thank you for having you on. So any final thoughts? Having designed Magic for how many years have you been here now? A lot.
Oh, like eight, I think.
Yeah.
Final thoughts. Go for the opportunity when you see it, because great opportunities don't always come up, and I hate to think about where I would be if I hadn't, on a whim, entered the Great Designer Search, because I'm very happy doing what I'm doing, and I'm very happy to have had the opportunity to do it.
Well,
so it's, don't let those pass you by, people.
Well, it's been, you and I have worked closely together now for many, many years, so I'm glad you took the whim, too. But anyway, guys, I've arrived at my desk, so we all know what that means. I mean, this is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. So thank you, Ethan, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, guys, and I will see all of you next time. Bye-bye.